Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Patience Without Waiting by Lama Adam Berner. For many of us, patience means waiting out unpleasantness so we can be happy when it's over. But the Buddhist practice of patience means increasing our ability to engage directly with difficult situations while reducing harmful tendencies of reactivity. We'll discuss some situations that deserve patience and techniques that can transform them into the path of awakening. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So I've been getting a lot of comments in the last couple weeks about my beard. People have been mentioning that it's longer, to which I usually respond like, yeah, I'm bringing in my winter coat. Some people have said it's grayer, and that's true too. And some people have said, you have a beard. And I've had a beard for 7 years. So what's different is I have glasses now. But everybody mentions the beard. And nobody's mentioned the glasses. So I think it's funny because that's, and to put this in like a Dharma context, lots of times when we encounter something we don't expect, we think it's something else. Or we put the, you know, we look at something different because it's surprising to us. You know, we miss a sign, what's different about the situation. So that's one little anecdote. The other little anecdote is these glasses. Like, I thought I was fine vision-wise forever. Like, I was just blessed with good vision. And the last couple months, my girlfriend's been saying, like, you squint a lot. And I'm like, no, I'm just concentrating. Like, I'm thinking. Like, this is what my face does when I'm thinking hard. And she kept bugging me about it, so I finally went to get an eye test. I hadn't had an eye test, you know, since like high school or something. And I went in there and I'm telling everybody there, like, yeah, my girlfriend just said I should come in here. There's nothing really wrong. I'm sorry if I'm wasting your time, you know. And they were like, well, do you have any problems seeing? And I said, well, you know, I mean, just when I'm looking at a computer for a long time. And I look at computers a lot, so I'm sure my eyes are just getting tired, you know. The whole time I'm like saying nothing's wrong, you know. And then they put me in that machine, you know, where they flip the things. And like, wow, it got so much better. Like, I had no idea. I thought that nature and beautiful views just had this sort of blurry sheen, and I thought that's what, like, distance did, you know, just in nature. And so, like, I would look at big vistas and think, like, oh, how beautiful, like, how it's got that softness to it, you know? Like, I had no idea what I wasn't seeing, you know? And so the point there is, we really don't know, you know, what things are like until we can actually get a glimpse, you know. We have no idea what we're missing, you know. And it's easy to fool ourselves into thinking that what we're seeing now is kind of all there is to see. So knowing that we can't even begin to know what we're missing until we have a glimpse, let's do everything we can to create the causes and conditions for such a glimpse to arise, you know. It's not as easy as like one of those machines, the photoroopter, I think they're called. But by listening to the Dharma, contemplating it, and doing our daily practice of meditation, that's what creates the causes and conditions to have those kinds of glimpses of what an awakened mind is like. That's what creates the circumstances for our vision to become clearer and clearer. And along the way, we'll definitely meet with experiences of unparalleled clarity like we've never seen before. It may be brief, and we'll need to keep listening and keep contemplating and keep meditating to increase the stability and the frequency of those kind of glimpses. And what that glimpse is of our true nature, like of our enlightened mind. And we can create the causes and conditions to have those kinds of glimpses. And when we do create those causes and conditions and have those glimpses, that becomes the legitimate idea for why we're doing it. Then we have like a real organic, natural reason to be doing our practice and contemplating this stuff. We have to see that to really understand, you know, why we're doing it. So that's just one way to think of like motivation. You know, we have to create the ability to actually get a glimpse, because until then we're kind of just, it's tough. It's tough to keep up our practice. It's tough to keep doing this stuff every morning, or, you know, to maybe interrupt our anger to think about causes and conditions and interdependence. You know, like that's a little frustrating sometimes. So we need to really get an idea of the why. And that why is going to come through some kind of genuine glimpse. So those are my two anecdotes. So before we say the prayer of refuge, let's just take a moment to rejoice that we've all come here today, that we're all here, that we made the decision to come in and think about waking up, you know, and having a happier life and helping other people be happier. That's worth rejoicing in. You know, not everybody has that inclination. So let's rejoice in that and set the attention to that our time here today is a benefit to all sentient beings. And we'll say the refuge prayer once in Tibetan, once in English, and once in Tibetan. O Sangye Chidang Soki Chodam La Janchu Padu Dani Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin Soki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchi Sangye Drupashu. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O Sangye Chidang Soki Chodnam La Janchu Padu Dakni Kyabsu Chi Daki Jin Soki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchi Sangye Drupa Sho. Then so in the marine poche, the kitchibo pedide, chula, cotton jumbo conejis, and te, kusun, taking a jub saldo. So, the other funny thing that happened this week is I went to pick up a order at Chipotle. I did the online ordering, you know, and I was like in a hurry. So I like ordered it before I left, went to Kroger, you know, in between to kind of, you know, I had 15 minutes. So I shopped real fast, got to Chipotle, and then had to wait 45 minutes for my order. And I was like, there's something here. I'm working on this talk on patience. And here I am standing waiting 45 minutes in Chipotle. This is what seems to happen. Like whenever you like give a talk, you end up getting confronted with the material you're working with. Very real situation. So one other thing before we get into the real substance of this talk is I was thinking this week about how I read in this book, it's in our library, it's called Debate in Tibetan Buddhism by Daniel Perdue. It's a very thick book, really interesting book about the tradition of debate in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a big part of the monastic college education, is to actually debate these topics. And one person like posits an idea and the other person has to try to refute it. And it's really quite animated. Like if you look online, you'll see videos of these, you know, there's lots of like slapping their hands and there's just like very traditional ways of doing it. It looks really cool. I wish I could understand. And I wonder if there's like maybe an English version of this. It would be really fun to see. Part of the reason I think it would be fun to see is that when you're trying to disprove the argument, you kind of get more points by making up the most absurd conclusion from somebody else's assertion. So you try to like make it as absurd or weird or funny, you know? And like, that is comedy. Like, that's what comedy is. It's like taking an assertion and making it like the most absurd thing you possibly can. So like, I feel like I wish, that's like the main reason I wish I could understand Tibetan, is to like listen to those debates and have a good laugh. But I wanted to bring it up today because one of the things that Daniel Perdue mentions in that book is he talks about like the things that make an argument true. And I can't remember what all of them are, but the first few seem obvious. But the third one is very different from what we normally think. The third or the last one, I can't remember. But that last one is that the person to which you're talking has to have an open mind. Like, they have to be willing to let their mind change. And that is a factor in whether your argument is true. Isn't that interesting? I mean, like, I could kind of shut down most of the dialogue on social media with that one little thing, right? Because like, the person you're talking to has to be open to changing their mind. So I would just say, check in with yourself right now. You know, are you open to having your mind change today? You know? Because ultimately only we can change our minds, but it's always up to us what we do with information. And maybe we just listen to something and we never think about it again. Maybe we put some time in and contemplate it after the fact. Maybe we actually try to apply it and test it in our lives. That stuff is always up to us. But if we aren't open to new information, to ideas that may challenge our habitual views about ourselves and the way the world works, then there's no chance for what I'm about to present to ring true. So I would say just kind of check in occasionally and make sure you're open. And so what we're going to talk about today, I'm using the book Peaceful Heart. Boy, I hope that's the right title. I've been reading it, and I haven't been looking at the cover. It's by Dzigar Khantrul Rinpoche, and it's a commentary on the patience chapter of The Way of the Bodhisattva. So if you want like the root text of this, you can look at the patience chapter of The Way of the Bodhisattva. And Dzigar Khantrul Rinpoche wrote this commentary, and I'll be covering about half of the book kind of today. So he starts out talking about this concept of sewa. And sewa is a Tibetan word that means like open heart, open, tender heart. And this immediately reminded me of, if anyone's read Pema Chodron's Welcoming the Unwelcome, she talks in the beginning about this open, tender heart being kind of like a wound. You know, like when we have like a wound, we have this tendency to want to cover it. It's like vulnerable, you know, and so we try to protect it, you know, and that's kind of our instinct, is to try to cover up that vulnerability and hide it. And but you know, like even with the wound, at some point you have to take the Band-Aid off and let it breathe, you know. So sewa is kind of like that, you know. It's this vulnerability, this tenderness, this openness that feels like there's a little habitual pull towards hiding it or covering over it. And we all have this nature, this sewa. This is our true nature, is this open, tender heart. And it's undisturbed by anything that happens. Like, it's just always there. But the busyness of our daily life tends to kind of hide it or cover over it. We forget that it's, like, always there. And ironically, we obscure it by being driven and ambitious and active in a pursuit of what we think is happiness, you know? Like, we're trying to find some kind of happiness, we're kind of flailing around, everything we find is a little impermanent, and in the course of this, we hide that heart more and more, that tenderness. We're afraid that by leaving it vulnerable, it'll somehow prevent our happiness. So one of the main things I want people to walk away with today is like a greater wish to like self-reflect and ask yourself questions about the way you're doing stuff, you know? So like, this is one of those questions, you know, like, are our methods working? Are our methods of being happy working, you know? And in particular, are these methods of closing up and covering up and hiding our vulnerability working out for us, you know? It's worth devoting time to. And when we examine this, we may discover that we have kind of two basic strategies that we can employ in the pursuit of happiness. We can put our tenderness and our love mainly on ourselves and those who are close to us in our circle, or we can explore a more selfless approach, benefiting others and embracing the world just as it is. So we have this sort of putting our love and tenderness just with those close to us, and we have sharing it with everyone we encounter. And so we should ask, how do these feel in retrospect? You know, how do situations in our lives where we've done these things feel? And how'd they work out? You know, not necessarily just in the moment, but in the long term. So we have to examine this in our own lives. You know, a big part of processing Dharma teachings is to personalize them. You know, I have my examples, and I'll share my own stories about things in my life, but like, we need, you know, each of you needs to take it and figure out how this applies in your own situations and think of examples in your own life where these things have happened or something similar has happened. We need to test them for ourselves. So we're told that by pushing beyond our usual comfort zone, by kind of sharing that sewa and openness with everyone, that we can feel a kind of unsurpassable joy and bliss. And we're told that that joy is like limitless, and that we can freely and willingly share it with everyone. So does this sound true? Do we have examples of this kind of experience in our own life, you know, where we have let ourselves be a little bit more open and vulnerable? Did we get a glimpse of that kind of bliss? As it said, our open, tender heart can expand to include everything. And that it's actually the source of all of our lasting joy and happiness. And in that way, it's kind of our most precious possession. And Zigar Khonsho Rinpoche here uses the example of like money in terms of precious things that we try to get. For most of us, wealth, comfort, those kinds of things are like our most prized possessions. And he says, with precious things like money, we work hard to gather, protect, and increase it. And we spend so much time gathering our wealth, protecting it and increasing it. Or we could say like our comfort, gathering comfort, protecting that comfort, and then trying to increase it. But we have to be thinking more about doing this with our sewa, with that open, tender heart. In this context, gathering would be like letting that heart be open. It's the natural condition of sewa, to be open and joyous. So gathering is really just sort of letting our nature be. Protecting it would be averting and removing obstacles and threats that can rob us of that open, tender, joyous state. And increasing it is by training and extending our love to include more and more beings. So the topic of patience really has to do with protecting our sewa, our open, tender heart, because we encounter a lot of threats to it in many forms. But they all arise from a heart that is somehow feeling disturbed. When we encounter something we don't like, we start to resist it. And in the process, our heart begins to close down. I saw this at Chipotle. So this is aggression. That is like the seed of aggression. That heart that's getting disturbed, that is discretion. It cuts off the flow of sewa. And on the large scale, aggression is pretty easy to understand. But we need to note that it's also irritation. Simple irritation is an instance of aggression. I remember here, actually over there, because it was in the old building, Kempo Carter Rinpoche, when he was here in like 2011 or 2013, talked about this, and about how like that initial feeling of resistance is actually an instance of aggression and anger. So we can't fool ourselves about that, you know. Shantideva in The Way of the Bodhisattva refers to aggression as being our sorrow-bearing enemy. And patience is its antidote. Zopa is the Tibetan word for patience, and it can also be translated as forbearance or tolerance. But tolerance and patience and forbearance all seem to apply some kind of like waiting it out. Like if we just kind of wait this out, then the reward will come later. You know, later we'll be happy if we can just distract ourselves enough to get through the present moment, you know. Just tolerate it for a little while, you know. Or just be patient, forbear it, you know. But Zeger Kanchel says the essence of patience, Zopa in the Tibetan, is actually more like not getting disturbed. And we could say that getting disturbed could take one of two forms, like either acting out or suppressing. But patience is neither of those. So how do we do it? First, we need to understand how we get disturbed, and then we need the antidotes. And patience is a practice, and it takes time. So if we're going to adopt this practice, we have to be ready to lean into some discomfort, but we also have to be prepared to fail a lot with grace and humor along the way. So the first verse of this patience chapter in the Way of Bodhisattva says, all the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity and offerings to the blissful ones, a single flash of anger shatters them. Similarly, Padampa Sangye says, one act of aggression is heavier than 100 acts of desire. So to put this in practical terms, aggression can't exist alongside sewa. Sewa is our nature, but when aggression rolls in, sewa is hidden away. And aggression is all we experience. A common analogy here is like darkness and light. If you walk into a windowless room and you turn the light on, the darkness is gone, you know. And as soon as you turn the light off, darkness floods back in. They can't exist in the same place. So we have to be on guard for every glimmer of aggression, every hint of getting disturbed. And aggression arises from our confused habits, habits that we've been cultivating for a very long time, habits that go against that open, tender heart. And when we notice these habits of confusion arising, our own habits of confusion, they have to be replaced with habits of wisdom. That's kind of the general way of talking about the antidote. So one of the keys is knowing our own confused habits and then knowing virtuous habits that can replace them. So that's just a real practical way about going about this, starting to get to know our own confused habits and figuring out specific things we can replace them with. We can each think of some examples we've applied, you know, like in the practice of Dharma, there's like mantra is a great thing to go to. If you're doing the practice of Tonglen, you know, you can actually actively do Tonglen in the moment, or you can use the three seeds, aspiration. To be very simple though, like just letting go is a great practice. You know, when these confused habits take place, there's some kind of fixation happening. And I'm thinking about the place where I was staying for a while last month. They had a picture in the bathroom. It was a beautiful picture of the Buddha. And it said, let that go. And I was like, funny placement in the house, but great sentiment, you know? So that's an example of something you can just do in the moment. It seems so simple, and it's also like really hard, but it, a lot of times, like, I just think of that, just let that go, you know? So all of our confused habits are based on clinging or self-cherishing. So one skillful habit is to make yourself aware of that habitual pull towards selfishness. And what's a big help here is mindfulness, you know? That's one of the reasons why we do mindfulness practice and cultivate mindfulness. But another big one is self-reflection, like genuine self-reflection, time actually devoted to thinking about this stuff. Kempo Carter Rinpoche gave the advice, I think it's in Dharma Paths, about like literally making a list of all your bad habits, you know, making a list of all the qualities about yourself that you want to change, making that list, and then ranking them, you know, and figuring out which are the most detrimental to your happiness. And then starting with those, you know, whichever ones are the most, working on those. And that's a tough thing to do, but it's worth trying, you know. It's absolutely beneficial. So practice in mindfulness and practice in self-awareness leads to awareness sooner when irritations arise. So one thing I noticed this when I was playing a lot of music. Like I was, when I was really playing all the time, like 5 to 7 things a week, you know, various bands and different stuff, like I was noticing my mistakes like all the time. Like I was just so aware of all of my mistakes, but because I was playing so much and practicing so much, they almost never actually were audible. You know, like I would hear these mistakes, but nobody else would hear them. And I've noticed this with Dharma practice too. Like when we first start developing some mindfulness and some self-awareness, a lot of times we'll notice our mistakes, but it's well after they've come out into the world and impacted us and other people. And then we go, ah, I wish I'd thought of that earlier. It's so clear in retrospect that I shouldn't have done that thing, you know, or that was the wrong way to do it. And that is, I think, for a lot of people, when you're new at this kind of practice, that's one of your experiences will likely be some kind of increasing frustration with noticing a whole bunch of mistakes in retrospect, you know? But what's neat is the more you practice, the closer, so if this is the moment where the mistake could come out into the world, and this is like after, the more you practice, the closer it gets to that moment of the thing happening, you know? And then it'll get to a point where kind of right while it's happening, you'll notice it, you know? And you may be able to change the course of it even right in the middle of your making a mistake, you know? And then eventually it becomes before, you know, and it actually becomes like seeing things you could do that are probably not a great idea and then being able to moderate it, you know. So just know that that does kind of change, you know, like that is one of, initially you may notice a lot more mistakes, but it will get to the point where you're noticing them before they come out into the world. But the irony of that is then you'll have to deal with the fact that you still have those thoughts of doing those things, you know. It gets more subtle, you know. It's like we're noticing these more subtle levels of clinging and aggression and things like that. But it's okay, you know what I mean? Like this is part of the process. And so thinking about self-reflection then, it's kind of the same way. You know, if we're actually reflecting about stuff off the cushion, thinking about our confused habits, thinking about the ways that we resist things, then when these moments actually come up, it's more likely that we're going to be aware right in the moment. So self-reflection increases self-awareness. And similarly, self-awareness gives us much richer things to work with in our self-reflection, you know? So if we're really paying attention in the moment, then when we go to reflect on it later, we're going to have a much deeper kind of contemplation to do. So another simple way we can protect our virtuous actions, which are virtuous actions are really our nascent virtuous habits, you know. So one way to protect them is through setting intentions and dedicating merit. So that's something we do a lot around here. You know, we set an intention in the beginning, and then at the end we dedicate the merit. And this strengthens the karmic impact of actions, makes them like stickier, you know, more likely to stick. The second verse of this chapter in Way of the Bodhisattva says, no evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience in various ways insistently. And Zeger Kontrol makes the point that we don't only lose our peace of mind when we react with anger, we also lose our strength. And we don't like that. He says, when we react with anger, we lose our peace of mind, but even more importantly, we lose our strength. All of us would prefer to go through life in a blissful mood, laughing and smiling through our days. However, we recognize that this isn't possible. In many situations, it's not even reasonable or appropriate. But what we can aspire to have is a mind that is always strong. More than bliss and ecstasy, having a stable inner strength is what fosters our self-esteem the most. Our strength determines how we feel about ourselves and the world. So a potential self-reflection here is, can you think of examples where your anger has damaged your self-esteem? I can't. Or can you think of examples when your patience and your warm-heartedness in a situation boosted your strength? When Shanti Deva says there's no austerity that compares with patience, austerity in this sense means going against our natural inclinations. So austerity is going against our normal habits of gathering, protecting, and increasing our comfort, and instead taking an unconventional path of unconventional thinking. And this unconventional thinking that we call dharma makes us feel stronger, have greater self-confidence in any situation. After time, we can even end up finding some exhilaration, meeting with situations that have potential to rouse our aggression. We start to see them as valuable opportunities to get stronger in our practice. Challenges become opportunities to reveal sewa, that open, tender heart. And we need to remember this. Zigar Khandro Rinpoche actually advocates generating a little bit of, he actually uses the word cocky, a little bit of a positive, cocky attitude about our ability to handle situations. And this makes it easier not to lose our temper, he says. So our habit is to follow our anger, and we've been doing it for a long time. But we need to work super hard, you know, to correct those inclinations. And the way we do that is applying this unconventional thinking. Later on in the Way of the Bodhisattva, Shantideva says, a patient person already has one foot in nirvana. And Zigar Khandro points out that patience means knowing our weaknesses. Patience is gaining familiarity with our tendencies for aggression, spotting them in the moment they arise, and remembering to apply their antidotes. So one way to think about this is, he presents 72 ways we get disturbed. And it starts like this. First of all, there's something called the 8 worldly concerns that some of you may have heard about. And these start with four things that we want. So we want pleasure, gain, praise, and good reputation. Those are like the 4 brands of things that we want. Things we do not want are pain, loss, blame, and bad reputation. So if you want like a rhyming thing to remember that, there's pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, bad reputation, and good name. So we have the 4 things we want, and the things we do not want. The first 4, the things we want, are based on expectation. So we're creating some sort of image of what we hope is coming, and we get attached to that. And the second 4 are things that we fear, based in anxiety, you know, don't want those things to come, and we get attached to that. So hope and fear, expectation and anxiety, cause a lot of problems for us, a whole lot of problems. So we have those 8. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, bad reputation and good name. These are 8 ways we get disturbed, but there's 72 of them. So over the next 3 hours, I'll be explaining them. So we'll get to 72 real quick with math. So we can experience those 8 in 3 ways. We can experience those 8 things as they relate to ourself. We can experience those 8 things as they relate to people we care about. And we can experience those 8 things as they relate to people we don't like. And ironically, when it's the people we don't like, we kind of usually feel the opposite of the way we feel when it's us or people we care about, you know. We're unhappy if they get praise, or we're happy if they get the blame, you know. So those 3 ways of experiencing the 8 worldly concerns, ourselves, people we care about, and people we don't like, get us to 24 ways of getting disturbed. And then the way we get to 72 is that we can experience any of those things in the past, in the present, or in the future. So we even just thinking about some instance of blame that happened in the past, you know, to ourselves is one way of 72. You know, or worrying about some, you know, not getting pleasure in the future, you know, is one way of the 72. And Zeger Khantra Rinpoche says we should be able to spot these, and that we should even contemplate each of these 72 as they relate to ourself. He says we try to think of real-world examples of all 72 of these in our own life. And he points out that this can be painful, and you probably shouldn't do it all in one sitting, and we shouldn't push ourselves past like a safe zone, you know, that we can engage with this. But he says it does need to be done. And he actually compares it to a colonoscopy. You just got to do it, you know. It's not fun, but it's for our protection. So that's some helpful self-reflection. But what about in the moment of disturbance? What about when we see aggression rising, hopefully just before or during, you know? First, it's important that we start working with low-stakes instances of disturbance. I always tend to think of the big stuff as when I want the practice to kick in, you know? But that'll never happen unless we remember to do that practice in the smaller, much more frequent instances of little everyday affronts to discomfort, or to affronts to our comfort. And they happen so often, we usually just let them slide by without a thought. But they're rich and fertile ground for growth and development. And we need to start seeing them that way. All those little low-stakes instances of discomfort. Each of us can probably think of like maybe 3 times today that we've been slightly irritated with something. Just in the hours we've been awake, there's probably been multiple instances of at least minor irritation, maybe before we even left our house, you know. And every one of those is a powerful opportunity for practice. It's a genuine opportunity to practice this unconventional thinking that lets our open, tender heart shine through. Zeger Khantra Rinpoche says, when we are feeling a low level of disturbance, such as mild irritation or disappointment, we tend to get trapped in the small space of our heads and make things worse by going around in circles with unhelpful reasoning. At these times, our habitual thought process usually blames our uncomfortable feelings on external events, but these events in themselves can't be the sole cause of our disturbance. Otherwise, we would be just as bothered when things happen to strangers as when they happen to us. Therefore, these emotions must have another cause. I needed to think about that, so I'm going to read it again. These events in themselves can't be the sole cause of our disturbance. Otherwise, we would be just as bothered when things happen to strangers as when they happen to us. Therefore, these emotions must have another cause. He goes on to say that cause is none other than our tendency to value ourselves more than we do others. In a word, our self-importance. We are in a contracted state of mind and heart, where all of our love and care is focused on ourselves or just a few individuals. In this state, if we stay in our heads and let the habitual thinking mind do what it will, our thoughts will follow their natural rut, which supports our self-importance and inflames our low-grade disturbance into outright anger and aggression. Our self-importance and its ego-centered reasoning are what spoil our cheerful happiness of mind. And one of the remedies Zeger Khantra suggests here, remember we're talking about low-grade disturbance, he suggests manufactured happiness and laughter as a remedy. He says, we can regard cheerfulness as the gatekeeper that prevents aggression from entering the precious temple of the heart. The face of that gatekeeper is smiling or laughing. And he points out that even forced fake laughter can lead to real smiles and real laughter. And so one way you can practice this, and this is one of those things that I kind of just found at some point in my life, but I remember realizing, I think I dropped some books or something and cussed, you know? And I was like, I dropped some books on the ground. Like, this is not a big deal, you know? And I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna start trying to laugh when I do stuff like this, you know? And then I remembered the other day because I was emptying the water bowls in my shrine, and I recently moved, and I didn't really have anything to empty the water into, but I found like a flower pot, you know, and a lot of times they have that bottom piece that comes off, right? And so I kind of pushed it in there. I was like, I think it'll stay, you know? And then I went in there and poured all the water in there and picked it up, and of course the bottom fell out and water all over my pants and the floor, and I laughed. Like, it was natural, you know? And I thought about how far I had come from, like, dropping a couple books and cussing to spilling water all over myself in the ground and it actually being funny, you know? So that's one way to kind of practice this stuff. Another bit of unconventional thinking is noticing that situations that we encounter are either like a dented copper pot or like a broken glass. And that means they're either fixable or they're just the way they are. And that's how it is. And it seems obvious, but in the moment, this is something we tend to forget, you know? So this is something worth asking actively in the moment, you know? Is this like a dented copper pot, or is this like a broken glass? Because part of our habitual confusion is not wanting to accept that suffering is a part of life. It's quite a significant part. In fact, when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, that's the first one. Suffering is a part of life. Suffering has a cause, which is attachment. If we can remove the cause, we can experience the cessation of suffering, and there's a path that leads to that cessation of suffering. But the first one is suffering is a part of life. And samsara, you know, what we call the cycle of birth and rebirth, is suffering. You know, the Buddha said samsara is just the way it is. It's suffering. So we can work on liberating ourselves and others from suffering and from that samsara, but a fundamental step is recognizing that suffering is a part of our life. Like, just recognizing that is the beginning first step. And we'll be happier.
I'm still not sure about that.
Me neither. Wow. Very profound, Siri. But we'll be happier, ironically, when we recognize that suffering is a part of life. And I was thinking back to in my 3-year retreat, there was a point where one of our people who'd done a previous retreat, because one of the things that happens in there is like you try to make yourself comfortable in all these little ways because it's so much austerity going on. So you try to come up with all these little ways to like put little comfort in your experience. And I remember Lama Yeshe said at some point, we need to stop trying to hack samsara. I thought that was really pretty cool, you know? Like, samsara is what it is. You know, we can work on our minds and we can do dharma, but we can't hack samsara. You know, it's not going to happen. So one might ask, like, what's wrong with our conventional thinking? And Zigar Khonsa Rinpoche says, the goal of most conventional thinking is to preserve the ego. This is our unconscious habit in default mode. The unconventional thinking of dharma, however, aims to preserve the peaceful heart of sewa. This requires conscious reasoning that is based on wisdom rather than habit. So knowing that life is suffering, we have two choices. One is living as we have, being upset at every disturbance, and then waiting for that perfect happy situation to come later on. Or we can see suffering as the key to our awakening, because it's suffering that helps us develop disenchantment with the cycle of suffering. So unconventional thinking and reverse psychology are like weapons in our battle against aggression and fear, Zigar Khonsa says. So another kind of unconventional thinking is when we encounter a situation, recalling that there's myriad causes and conditions that came into that situation arising. Everything arises interdependently based on a huge web of causes and conditions. And every one of those causes and conditions has its own set of causes and conditions. So instead of being reductive about it and trying to boil it all down to one thing, which it isn't, you know, like we can actually contemplate in the moment, you know, the interdependence of things. That's a better thing to do when we start to feel that aggression rise, than to start to do what we normally do, which is get all Sherlock Holmes and try to figure out the one reason this thing happened, you know? Another thing about causes and conditions that Ziegler Kontrol points out here, which I think is really neat, is he points out how hard it is not to react in certain ways initially. I mean, there's a lot of causes and conditions that come into our aggression, and that's why it's so hard to really practice patience. And that's why we have to keep trying, you know, again and again and again, even when we fail, and give ourselves a little grace, you know, because there's a lot of habit energy that's gone into this. There's a lot of cultural energy. There's lots of reasons why we act in certain ways. So it's not, you know, we have to generate an openness to the fact that sometimes we're gonna fail, you know. So, and sometimes after we get upset, we realize how silly it was. You know, like I said, sometimes after the fact, we recognize how silly it was to get upset about something. And that recognizing that silliness, he says, is actually a good thing. And that's actually humor, you know. That's one of the ways that we can open up to humor. And we need to notice the humor involved in our blaming external things and people for our feelings, you know. That's kind of funny, you know. And that kind of humor helps us to work with the small irritations so that we're more prepared for the big ones. And we can also connect our little moments of anger or irritation with the tendencies of all beings. You know, that's one of the ways where we can cultivate compassion, is recognizing that this is all of humanity is sharing in this. You know, like, we all get angry, we all get irritated. But do we get angry at our physical conditions or like natural disasters? Do we get angry at them? And the point Ziegler Kontrol is making here is he says, we make excuses for getting angry at other beings because we assume they have an intrinsic agent. Like, we assume they have a self that's doing the thing to us, you know? That's why we get mad at people, but we don't get mad at, like, an avalanche, you know? But we have to consider how many times we've met with circumstances that led to emotions and reactions from us that we didn't anticipate or desire, you know? How many times did we meet with situations where we kind of lost control? He says, the arising of anger can be compared to the arising of an image in a mirror. An object placed before a mirror has no intention to produce a reflection, nor does the mirror have any intention to reflect. But the meeting of the two is a sufficient cause for an image to appear. In the case of anger, there is the meeting of the provoking circumstance and the person who is provoked. The circumstances that provoke the anger have no prior intention to do so, and the mind that reacts has no prior intention to be provoked. But when the two come together, anger arises. This is how habitual unconscious reactions are generated. So, does anyone ever have the intention to get angry? And when you get angry, are you in control? Can you think of times when you've been overpowered by your reactivity and emotion? When we can understand our own loss of control in the throes of anger, we're better able to transform situations when others treat us with larger doses of anger. When we understand our own loss of control at the hands of anger, we have a better chance of turning an unfortunate situation into a potentially productive one. And we can also remember that the person who's angry is likely suffering more than we are in those moments, as we're actually aware of what's happening. And we can use that as an opportunity to cultivate our open, tender heart. Another way to think about things in the moment is to examine our assumptions about reality. Like we say, that nothing is singular, unchanging, or autonomous. So for instance, when someone's mad at you, like, what part of the person are you mad at? You know, are you mad at their body? Are you mad at their mind? If you're mad at their mind, like, is it like a specific thought or their personality? Like, which element of this whole collection of causes and conditions are you mad at? You know? Also, our bodies and minds change day to day, so which part of our own body or mind are we potentially angry at? And in terms of autonomy, we have to notice that everything arises from numerous causes and conditions. And so, you know, like the example of the mirror, you know, can we really, what are we really, where's the object of our anger here? And these kind of contemplations may not instantly make the anger go away, but they do redirect the mind to something much more productive than where our mind might normally go, to blame or to reify and oversimplify our experience to the point where it's completely disconnected from the way things really are. And after that kind of an examination, you can let the mind rest in an open, self-reflective state. Shantideva points out that as much as we want happiness, we cause ourselves and others so much suffering, and all based on the mistaken belief in an intrinsic self. All aggression and other afflictive emotions arise from that belief. And when we're suffering, we forget everything arises interdependently. We forget about all the countless causes and conditions, and instead we fixate on one particular cause and lose the ability to control our emotions. We have yet to build up the strength and the momentum of reflecting on the causes and conditions that make things come about. That's one thing Zygmunt Kontrol says. So on the Bodhisattva path, we have to recognize that people in the throes of afflictive emotions are not autonomous beings with control over their actions. He says we mustn't react as if they have a clear intention to harm us, for that is not the case. We can't expect beings to behave as though they're enlightened when they're not. We know that about ourselves. You know, we can't expect it of other people too. Given the confusion and fixation of sentient beings, it should be unsurprising that we act in childish ways. But being in this kind of environment, we have lots of opportunities to work with our aggression. And that's why many bodhisattvas choose to be reborn here in this human realm, because it's the perfect setting in which to train one's mind. It's perfect. And I'll close with this analogy. It's the analogy of the stick, someone hitting me with the stick. This took a long time for me to get. But if someone hits you with the stick, you don't hold the stick responsible, because you know that the stick has neither the will or the autonomy to hit you. You know, we don't hold the stick responsible. We know that the stick has a person using it, you know, so we get angry at the person. But like the stick, the person holding it is in the grips of anger, which, as we know, makes us vulnerable and out of control. So it would make much more sense to get angry at the anger that's driving the person holding the stick. To extend this logic further, aggression arises based on many, many causes and conditions. But the fundamental cause is our clinging to the illusion of a self. That's the fundamental cause of aggression. And our ignorance of the actual state of things is the root of the whole process. And that ignorance is the root of all of our suffering, and it affects everyone. So can we blame someone for what they don't know, you know? Zygmunt Kontrol Rinpoche says this would be like blaming a blind person for not knowing your hair is brown. So if we can contemplate this and apply it in our lives, we'll realize that there's never a sound reason to get angry at anyone. And I'll quote Mama Kathy here, because I think this is really important. It may be normal to get angry, but is it necessary? You know, that's really the question to ask here. So we will, as we try to apply these teachings, continue to react and occasionally lash out. But sticking with this training will gradually chip away at our habitual tendencies to react out of aggression. And applying these unconventional methods of thinking, you know, a little self-reflection in the moment, trying to send our mind in these unconventional ways, will redirect in a positive direction. And, you know, I think we all know how it feels to be open and genuine and generous and kind. And that's really where happiness is coming from, you know. So, yeah, I think that's all I have to say today. Any questions? Would you mind using the question mic so people online can hear you? You don't have to. I'll repeat it. Oh, okay, welcome.
I have a ton of questions as you're talking about. Probably the most important one, I'm familiar with 12-step programs.
Okay.
You talked about making a list of what in 12 steps is referred to as character defects. You call them bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any guidance about it, any text, in 12-step programs, there's a ton of guidance.
Yeah. So the question, just to make sure I'm understanding correctly, the questioner is saying that she has some familiarity with 12-step programs, and there's making of lists involved in that too. But there's a lot of guidance in 12-step programs for generating those lists, and is there guidance available here, basically, to make a list about our own defects, like I mentioned in the talk today, right? Well, the root would be clinging to an idea of, it's tough in the beginning, I think, it was really hard for me to get my head around self, clinging to self. But what helped me was the self-identity, the idea that, like, I feel like, for instance, like any statement, like, I'm the kind of person who blank, you know? So like, for instance, if I'm the kind of person who, you know, when I get in traffic, I just get annoyed, you know, like there's an affront to our self-identity, you know? So like things that challenge our self-identity demonstrates that clinging to it. So when something when we're around someone who doesn't think that we're charming and pleasant, that's hard for us, right? Because that goes against our self-identity. But if we're around someone who laughs at all of our jokes, that's great because it increases, empowers our self-identity, our clinging to the self-identity. Good. So that's one way. I mean, you can probably generate a whole list right out of there, you know? That would be the most general way of talking about it, I think. There other ways of talking about it would be maybe getting into, like, because there are lists of, like, the afflictive emotions. Five in general are, like, ignorance, anger, pride, desire, and jealousy. Those are, like, the main five we talk about. So noticing the ways that those arise in our own, like, situations. Really, I think, because I don't want to make this too complicated, so to keep it simple, I would say, like, instances of clinging to one's self-identity, both the positive and the negative, and in particular, ones that are habitual, you know, things that we see happening a lot. You know, maybe not all the time, but they happen again. Maybe they don't happen all the time, but they've happened several times in your life, and it was really bad, you know? They keep recurring.
And then you mentioned that the biggest cause is self.
Sure.
Self-identity that you're
Yeah. So the The questioner is asking, I said that self was the cause of suffering. So I want to clarify that fixation on the idea, the appearance of a self, is the problem. So the appearance of a self just kind of happens. It's an appearance. But it's our clinging to it as real, or as, to jump back to something in the talk, as singular, as unchanging, as autonomous. It's clinging to that and sort of solidifying that idea. That's the cause of suffering. Yeah. And so, and interestingly, the other side of it is, like, if we were to act in these, like, perfectly enlightened ways, you know, then it would be sort of like an enlightened being in these, this iconography and stuff. And, like, is that a self? I don't know, but we are looking at a being, a picture of a being, you know, and that's not necessarily the whole story, but, like, there's always this idea of, like, you know, there has to be a central point in the mandala, you know, from which all of our view, you know, we have our own relative view in a situation. So we could have a self that's based on fixation and clinging, or we could have a self that is open and tender, like that sewa, that open heart, you know. So self... Yeah, self itself is not the cause, but the fixation is. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Paul.
I'm Adam. Thank you.
You're
great.
Welcome.
Wonderful to see you.
Good to see you.
I like those glasses.
Thank you.
How the beard's got to go, though.
Thank you.
just kidding. So it strikes me that you're saying something quite radical, and I want to make sure I get it.
Yep.
And then I can decide whether to change my mind.
Exactly, yeah.
God forbid. So what you're saying then is, ultimately there's never any need for anger, to get angry. And ultimately, there's never any benefit from getting angry. Is that is what you're saying, right?
Yes. Okay. And I'll say too that I asked Kemba Carter Rinpoche once, and I think this question probably gets asked a lot of times, but when I asked him, I said, because I thought there has to be a reason, a time for righteous anger,
yeah.
You know, like that has to be the case, you know, and he said no. He said no, you know, I mean, like I said earlier, and like we explained in the talk, like there are causes and conditions will bring up anger out of habit and things like that, but the fact is that anger clouds our wisdom, you know, like when that sewa is closed off, we talked about it today in terms of like an open, tender heart, but that's also our wisdom. And our wisdom is where our skillful means come from,
yeah.
You know, our ability to actually impact things in the right ways, in the most efficient and effective ways, you know. So anger clouds that and shuts that off and kinks the hose of wisdom. So the idea, I know it is super duper radical, and I am so not there right now myself either, but I have seen, but this is another way where small situations you can see. If you do the low stakes situation, like one way, maybe this applies, maybe it doesn't. I noticed a long time ago, somebody said to me, if you're in a hurry, you're running late or something, and you're really like in a hurry and stressed, you're gonna make more mistakes. You're gonna drop things, you're gonna forget stuff. But like it, and it's something I took to heart. And so now when I run late, I don't change anything about the way I'm doing. I just try to get it done, you know, and I'm less likely to fumble with stuff and forget things, because in that bit of resistance, you know, in that bit of irritation, it just kinks off the wisdom,
yeah,
you know?
True. Okay. So just to add, not to add, but just to maybe expand the question, if that's okay. I hope there's nobody else waiting for the mic. I want to hog the mic. part of what you're saying, or at least an element of it, I think, is that ultimately there's no true self to be angry, and there's no true person to be angry at. So what's the point? I mean, is that part of what you're saying?
I think that's a pretty good summation. Yeah, like, I mean, we ourselves are a beating of causes and conditions. Like, one way we describe the self is like a river. You know, it's just like a bunch of things that have come together in the moment. Like, when you look at a river, it looks like the river down there. You know, it's like We call that the Scioto, but it's not the same water that was there, you know, now. It's different water from an hour ago, you know, and it's kind of the same thing with us, and it's the same thing with other people, and it's the same thing with our circumstances. There's an appearance of a self, and there's an appearance of an other, and on a relative level, we have to work with that, but we can't think that that's the whole story, and clinging to that as being the whole story only causes problems.
Well, that becomes a challenge for how we think about ourselves, and I won't ask you to go there. I think that's another topic. But if it's not this, then what is it?
If it's not this, let's go there. Yeah. wait, let's go there. What do you mean? If it's not this, then what?
Well, if I'm not who I always thought I was, whatever that is, if it's not a true self that I hold on to that I think I am, and it's not, and I'm not, then what?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. And that does seem, maybe that should be the next talk.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, but to, a quick answer for that is generated in awareness, you know? A quick answer to that is like, there is a way of being aware without clinging to a central kind of thing, you know? And then experience continues on and things appear to continue happening. But it's just not kind of shrunk down into a...
Okay, that makes sense. Well, that's why we meditate.
Good, yeah, exactly, you got it.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, I think... Oh yeah, we're running late, I apologize. So I just wanna say thank you to everybody for coming today. On Thanksgiving tip, I wanna say thank you for Lama Kathy and Lama Tom, who've been so generous to me and I continue to learn so much from. Thank you to all the volunteers at KDC, from the people who move around cushions to the board. Thank you particularly to all my patrons who make a lot of my Dharma work possible. And then we will dedicate the merit, which as we said earlier, is a good way, intention, action, dedicating. So we'll say this in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry I went late. I didn't look at the watch. All right.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.